The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. My guest today is Dr. Steve Novella, academic clinical neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine. He's the host and producer of the weekly science podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. He's also a senior fellow and director of science-based medicine at the James Randi Educational Foundation, and a number of other things that we'll get to throughout the show. Thanks very much for being here, Dr. Novella.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So to give our listeners some background, what's the definition of science-based medicine?
Well, it's pretty much what it says. It's using the best science that we currently have in order to apply that to the practice of medicine. It actually goes one step beyond evidence-based medicine, a term perhaps your listeners are more familiar with. Evidence-based medicine focuses primarily on the clinical evidence, hence the name, and doesn't focus as much on plausibility. How likely is it that something should work? Does it fit with our concept of, you know, biology and everything we know about, you know, how drugs work and human physiology, anatomy, et cetera? Science-based medicine says we want to consider all of that information. Because science has to all hang together. You can't have, you know, one pocket of science that is mutually incompatible with another pocket of science. It's all describing the same reality. It's all got to fit together. And scientists know this. This is how science functions. So we simply want to apply what scientists take for granted and do every day strictly to the practice of medicine.
So do you think that there's maybe a bit of confusion around that distinction then between science-based medicine and evidence-based medicine?
There is, partly because we're introducing a new term and a new concept. You know, the proponents of evidence-based medicine also definitely blur the lines. If we've certainly had conversations with them, over email and writing and in person, and they will often say, "Well, that is evidence-based medicine. We consider plausibility." So they definitely pay lip service to that. But then in practice, when you read an evidence-based medicine review of a topic, sometimes they completely ignore prior plausibility. And there's also a very technical difference in how we approach the evidence. Evidence-based medicine tends to rely on the p-value. You may have heard what a p-value is. Like, oh, this study showed that the results are due, the probability of the results being due to chance are less than 5%, which is actually not an accurate way to describe the p-value. But that's often how it's presented. And what we want to do is take a Bayesian approach, which says, all right, how likely is this before we do this study? And then once we get the evidence from this study, how does that affect the prior probability? What's our post probability? And it's a mathematically, statistically different approach to the evidence. We think it's a better approach. And there are others, you know, who agree with that. So it's not just, a vague or conceptual. It's actually a very practical, statistical difference in how we're approaching the evidence.
Someone who doesn't agree is Dr. Oz, and you were just a guest on that show. So first of all, how did that appearance come to be?
They called me on a Tuesday and said, can you be in the studio on Friday? And it was based on a number of blog posts that we had written at Science-Based Medicine and some of our personal blogs as well, being highly critical of Dr. Oz. It's hard for me to say how much of this was driven by the producers. I think the producers of the show just need to put out a ton of content, and they seemed very reasonable. I don't know how much of it was Dr. Oz himself wanting to answer his critics, mm-hmm. and he just sort of needed a sacrificial lamb, as it were. He needed somebody on the show that he could answer to. He certainly seemed to have a preset, you know, spiel that he wanted to give during that episode. He wasn't really interacting much with what I was saying. He just wanted to say his piece.
Absolutely. You could tell he was sticking to his talking points. Even the title of that episode was, Why is Your Doctor Scared of Alternative Medicine?
Well, everything was a straw man. And I knew going in that was going to be the biggest challenge. I could certainly address any direct questions that he asks me, but the challenge is always that they frame the topic in such a way that there's a lot of assumptions just in how they frame it. So he framed it as alternative medicine is this unstoppable new wave in medicine. But there are these skeptical holdouts, and he used that term, who are just afraid of something. What are they afraid of? So that's how they frame the whole thing. Of course, it's nonsense. If we're afraid of anything, it's that patients are going to be subjected to harmful or worthless or magical therapies, and we're not doing the best that we can for them by doing our due diligence and following logic and evidence. But we're not afraid of the unknown or anything the way they were framing it. It's just we have very well thought out, very good reasons for defending the approach to medicine that we take. It's actually the approach that most practitioners take. In fact, it's the basic assumption. They're the ones who are coming in and we're trying to change 100 years of tradition and hard-won tradition in medicine by trying to go back to the pre-scientific era when we didn't base our treatments on the best available scientific evidence. But they're couching it in a very savvy, very marketing savvy way in a lot of dressing that is a bait and switch. They're trying to dress it up as patient-centered medicine, and he's grassroots sort of empowering, self-empowering medicine. He hit this theme really hard, during the show, or healthcare freedom. These are the themes that they hit, but it's nonsense. It has nothing to do with any of that. They just want to use modalities that are not based on good science. That's it.
What would you say the average doctor's perspective on alternative medicine really is? And maybe I shouldn't say alternative medicine, alternative treatments.
There's no good category because, and we sort of shy away from using, the category of alternative medicine is framing, complementary medicine or integrative medicine. These are all, again, their attempt at framing it to make it sound like this is all compatible. We're just adding these new treatment ideas to the scope of practice, but really they're just trying to water down a road and in many cases destroy the scientific standard that we have been using to decide what treatments work and which treatments are safe.
What would you say that the average doctor's perspective is?
Oh, yes,
is?
Right. Mm-hmm. So we refer to them largely as shruggies, a term I think that was coined by Val Jones, one of the writers for us at Science-Based Medicine, because this is absolutely my experience as well. The vast majority of physicians have no idea what it is. They think it's all what they're being told by the promoters who are framing it as this sort of patient-centered, touchy-feely, medicine. All things that we think of as we want to be that, right? As practitioners, I want to be patient-focused, and I want to consider the whole patient and to use consider quality of life. Yeah, those are all good things. I mean, absolutely, we got to talk about nutrition and exercise and not just over rely on drugs and procedures. These are all things that have already been incorporated into the thinking about mainstream medicine. It's actually nothing new to the alternative medicine movement, but they're co-opting it as their Trojan horse so that they can bring in the pseudoscience behind it. But most practicing physicians have no idea, no clue. And they're told, oh, this is, don't worry about it. This is all just touchy-feely medicine. Like, okay, whatever. They're easily cowed by that. And there's a sense of political correctness as well. Like, oh, we don't want to go against this because it's popular in some way. Sometimes it's being promoted by non-physicians. So, there's a bit of sort of professional sensitivities going on as well. So they're happy just to bury their heads in the sand and not think about it too much. And then when they do get exposed to what it actually is, and I've had this experience even in academic settings, I was trying to tell some of my colleagues, we were considering a course because actually the regulatory bodies have forced us to teach alternative medicine to medical students now in order to get accredited. So we had to come up with some course, and I was trying to make it as science-based as possible. But the proponents had their teaching material all ready to go, right? And I was trying to tell them, this is what this is. It's really unscientific. It's not appropriate for us to teach to our students. We have to look at it very carefully and carefully vet everything that gets taught. And they were like, yeah, we'll do that. But they had no idea. Then when we got the syllabus for the first such course that was going to be taught, I just saw the cardiologist was thumbing through the cardiology section. And after about 20 minutes, he looked up with utter shock on his face and said, "This is complete nonsense." And then afterwards, he confessed to me. He said, I didn't believe what you were telling us until I read that syllabus. And then I realized that you weren't being, you know, an alarmist, that in fact it was much worse than what you were making it out to be. So they just don't know. They just don't get it. They don't understand how unscientific and pseudoscientific it all is until it's really put in their face.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Dr. Steve Novella, academic clinical neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine and the president and co-founder of the New England Skeptical Society. If you wouldn't mind, can we just go over some of the questions that Dr. Oz asked you? Because sitting in the virtual audience, there were some bits that I really wanted to hear more about. His very first question was, why don't you and other science-based medicine proponents want us to talk about alternative health treatments? Now, my understanding is that you do, in fact, want people to talk about it. You just want them to do it in a different way.
Exactly. So another straw man. Every question was sort of begging the question. We talk about it all the time. I lecture at my colleagues about it. I lecture to students about it. I teach this almost every day as part of, you know, my academic practice. We absolutely, you know, want people to be talking about it. We just want them talking about it from a science-based perspective. Our problem with Dr. Oz is not that he's talking about alternative medicine, is that he's talking about it gullibly and uncritically. He recently had on his show, for example, an episode where he was promoting homeopathy, and he did so without a hint of skepticism, barely even registering that, you know, maybe there are some people out there who don't believe this. It was utterly shocking. So that's our problem, is that his information is misleading. It's just flat out wrong in some instances, or it's completely eliminating the scientific perspective on that information. He's promoting nonsense. That's the problem that we have. Not just that he's talking about it, which we do ourselves quite a bit, actually.
Well, you brought up the fact that studies have been done on various things like ginkgo biloba and echinacea, and it turns out they don't work. But Dr. Oz said that studies have been done showing that they do work. So that's a pretty clear divide. So are you working on different standards of evidence then, or is there something else behind that?
Oh, yeah. See, they're working on a double standard of evidence where there's the normal standard that has evolved and is continuing to evolve, you know, in terms of understanding. There's a very complicated relationship, actually, between scientific evidence and the practice of medicine. And it's something that is constantly being reviewed and debated and examined. But there are pretty robust consensus standards of how we interpret the evidence. You know, you can argue and dither about where exactly to draw the line in terms of, you know, doing more benefit than harm or having a favorable risk versus benefit ratio. But there are general rules. You know, we sort of know how to apply evidence to the practice of medicine. Proponents of alternative medicine are turning those standards on their heads, and they are publishing articles that are arguing directly for the watering down of the scientific standard. In fact, Dr. Weil just did that, just published an article, which I wrote about last week on science-based medicine, where he was, again, this very coy, elaborate, deceptive language, but at the end of the day was saying, we want to promote therapies that are not tied to this, you know, randomized controlled clinical trial. That's ruling, you know, the practice of medicine, and it's wrong. In his argument, this is what he's saying, that we should allow for other kinds of evidence. So essentially what they're saying is they want to use pragmatic studies. Pragmatic studies are ones in which the it's like a real-world application of a treatment. So you just follow, you know, the either an intentions-to-treat model, you know, the physician intends to treat a patient with a certain therapy, or just, you know, in an unblinded way, mm-hmm. what happens when patients actually get treated with these therapies out in the real world. And that's a good type of study to do comparative treatments and also to see how a treatment that has been shown to be effective in rigorous trials is applied in the real world. But it's not a way to answer the question, does the treatment work? Because it's not controlled. It's complementary to, it's in addition to a randomized controlled trial. It's what you do once you've already proven through very highly controlled blinded trials that something actually is safe and effective. So what Weil did was say that, well, there's problems with randomized controlled trials. They're not perfect. It's an idealized situation. It doesn't necessarily always apply to the real world. Therefore, they're not sufficient. But then he went and he made this logical leap to say, therefore, they're not necessary. And that was a completely logical fallacy. No, you're right. They're not sufficient, but they are necessary. And it's insane to do a pragmatic study on a treatment that hasn't been proven to work in an idealized condition under randomized control trials yet. But that's what they want to do. They want to bypass rigorously blinded control trials and do the messy, unblinded, uncontrolled trials, because those are the ones in which their treatments work. It's totally transparent to anyone who's been following, you know, their claims in their literature, but that's what they're doing. They're arguing for a watering down of the standard. So, of course, when we look at the evidence with the, you know, what I consider to be an objective scientific standard, the same kind of standard that we apply to non-controversial or non-quote-unquote alternative therapies, we come up with one assessment. When they look at the same evidence, they want their double standard. They want to use these weaker forms of evidence. You know, they want to cherry pick the positive studies. They dismiss the need for more rigorously controlled trials. They ignore the history of medicine, which tells us that these lower, you know, grade forms of evidence are highly misleading and highly preliminary, and we shouldn't be basing our clinical judgments on it. They want to go backwards a couple hundred years, and it's really just insane.
Well, what do you think about sort of, I guess I'd call it the underlying theme of that episode, the idea that science just can't figure out the mechanism behind a lot of these alt health treatments, or they can't test them effectively, and that they do work, and they've worked for thousands of years, and someday medical science will figure out why, and we'll all look really silly.
Yeah, well, you know, that's always, you know, my beliefs will be confirmed in the future. It's a false argument from authority. You know, you're basically saying, just you wait, I'm going to be proven right in the future. Well, everyone thinks they're going to be proven right in the future. That's not an argument. It's not anything that actually you can use today to support your position. What evidence, what logic do you have, you know, right now? And you didn't really have anything to say to that. I actually got the opportunity to call him on another one of his straw men. He accused me of saying that I'm dismissing acupuncture because it can't possibly work. Mm-hmm. But we just don't understand the mechanism in our Western sort of limited approach to things. That actually wasn't what I was saying. What I actually said about acupuncture is that the evidence shows that it doesn't work, completely separate from the plausibility mechanism argument. If you just look at the clinical data, it doesn't work. Whenever you control for where you stick the needle, it turns out it doesn't matter. When you control for whether or not you stick the needle in the skin, right? You could either stick the needle through the skin down to the right depth and elicit the what they call the dekey, you know, the sensation that you're supposed to get, or you could just poke the surface of the skin with dull needles or with toothpicks, even in some studies. And guess what? It makes no difference. So if you're not sticking needles in acupuncture points, and that's just as effective as going through the highly trained and specified, you know, acupuncture treatments that is, in fact, the essence of acupuncture, there's no difference. Therefore, acupuncture doesn't work. All they're seeing is a nonspecific placebo effect from the ritual that surrounds acupuncture, which is not acupuncture. It's just the therapeutic ritual, which, you know, you could substitute then anything for acupuncture. As long as you're getting the kind attention of the therapist, you'll have the same level of a placebo effect. In fact, that's been studied as well. When you enhance the interaction between the acupuncturist and the patient, the effect is better. When you change where you stick the needle, no difference. When you don't stick the needle in the skin versus sticking it in, no difference. So that's how, you know, the science-based practitioners interpret that research. It's actually pretty clear cut. If it were a drug, the conclusion would be the same. You know, when the placebo of a drug works as well as the drug itself, we don't say the drug works through a placebo effect, or it's so effective that even the placebo of the drug works. We say it doesn't work. When you control for everything but the physiological response to the treatment and there's no difference, that's something which does not work. The fact that we don't understand how acupuncture might work reduces its plausibility. So when you combine the two, low plausibility, not zero, because something's actually physically happening, you know, you're sticking a needle through the skin, but I would say low but non-zero plausibility with dead negative evidence. When you look at the best studies, the ones that are actually, you know, controlling in a blinded way the actual variables of acupuncture, this is not something that is supported by science. Now, he tried to dismiss that himself by saying, well, that's your Western science, and that's the old canard, your science can't
right.
study my belief system, and that's just nonsense. You know, what is it about the scientific method that's not capable of documenting whether or not there's an effect from acupuncture? You can't answer that question. No one can answer that question because it's silly. All science is controlling for variables, counting all of the outcomes, looking in a rigorous, systematic way, controlling for biases. You know, it's really just looking very rigorously and carefully. That's all it is. So it's just like saying this phenomenon is there except when you look at it closely, and then it vanishes because there's some problem with the way you're looking. No. When something vanishes when you look at it closely, that's an illusion. That's something that's not really there.
Now, we have a plethora of audience questions about your appearance on Dr. Oz. First one is from Richard Saunders.
What feedback from other doctors have you had after being on Dr. Oz?
The feedback has been all positive, although I'm assuming there's a self-selection bias in there. I don't think if someone was highly negative, they probably wouldn't come up to me and tell me. But you know, most people think that I did the best I could under the circumstances. And I think to those who were paying attention, like your reaction, it was pretty transparent that Oz was not really addressing my responses and was sticking to his script. So I think that backfired a little bit on him. At least that's what I'm hoping. The only negative feedback that I've read on blogs, for example, are from, you know, the lunatic fringe in the alternative medicine world. I won't even go into the kind of nonsense that some of them have published. But just from like my colleagues and from even patients and other physicians, it's all been pretty positive.
A question from Jim W.
Isn't your appearance on Dr. Oz's show rather like arguing with creationists? If you engage with them, you lend them credibility. But if you decline, you're labeled a coward, or it's presented as proof that you have an inferior position.
Yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, and we do draw the line. If there is somebody who is so prominent already in the media that, you know, I am unlikely to affect their credibility or their exposure, but they're having a massive impact themselves, we need to address that person. We need to confront them and address the claims that they're making. So, I mean, Dr. Oz is a huge phenomenon. He has a vast audience that hangs on his every word. He doesn't need me to lend him any credibility or to expand his audience or whatever. I do think that introducing a little bit of critical thinking and skeptical thinking on his show could only have a positive impact.
Well, obviously, he does have a particular perspective on what he sees as the truth about medicine, both mainstream medicine and alternative health. So do you think that he's extreme in any way? Are his views particularly radical?
Not for the community itself. You know, so before I went on the show, you know, we had our internal debate. How much does Dr. Oz really buy all this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
How much of it is just him saying what he needs to say to get it on Oprah, to get his own show, to promote himself to the media? I still think it's probably a combination of both. But after, you know, being on the show, I was struck by a couple of things. One is that he is absolutely steeped in the standard beliefs of that culture. He had the absolutely prefab standard responses and approach to the questions and the challenges to his position. So he is in bed with, if you will, the alternative medicine community. And he struck me as believing it, as this was his position. You never really know, you know, what
right.
people really believe in their heart of hearts, but he's presenting himself that way. I don't think he's extreme for that community. I think he was regurgitating the things we've heard 100 times before. Absolutely, you know, lockstep position.
But the size of his audience, as you mentioned, does that make his views more dangerous?
Oh, absolutely. He has a huge audience, and that comes with it a huge responsibility. And that's why we are choosing to single him out for criticism. He's not obviously not the only person that we criticize, but he's somebody worthy of criticism because of his audience. And he's, in our opinion, failing in his responsibility to that audience by, you know, teaching them utter nonsense. He'll have a segment where he sticks right with the evidence and it's all pretty mainstream and standard. And then he mixes in with that, here's homeopathy, it's utter nonsense. Or he'll have John Edward on his show who alleges to speak to the dead. And again, he's promoting someone who, in my opinion, is a con artist and a charlatan. That he's using his cred as a physician and his audience in order to promote this. So, he deserves what he gets in terms of criticism.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Dr. Steve Novella, the host of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and Senior Fellow and Director of Science-Based Medicine at the James Randi Educational Foundation. So do you have any particularly bad examples of health stories that were horribly reported in mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every day. The media does a horrible job on the aggregate of reporting science stories in general and medicine stories in particular. Unfortunately, this is getting worse because as the business model of print journalism is collapsing, there are fewer people who can actually make it their living off of journalism. And as newspapers are downsizing, they're often getting rid of the specialists like science writers and science editors and putting more generalist journalists to cover the science beat. There are still great science journalists out there, don't get me wrong. But again, in the aggregate, on average, the lowest common denominator is pretty bad. Often what we see is journalists printing press releases verbatim. You know, you put out a press release about some scientific discovery mm-hmm. that you've made. You put your own spin on it, how wonderful it is, going to change the world. And if a journalist doesn't do any actual investigation, doesn't check with a scientist, doesn't see what, you know, what the community is saying, they just printed verbatim. It's a lazy way to get an article on your website or in your newspaper. Or they take a single person's word for it. They invest authority in a single scientist, which is never a good idea because there is no scientific authority in the individual. It's the community that carries weight, where biases and ideas tend to average out over many people. So you always have to find out what the community is saying at large, not just an individual, but I think a lot of journalists make that confusion. Or they do what we call false balance, where they will put a fringe crank on a par with somebody representing the mainstream consensus opinion as if they're two equal sides. And it's a controversy, and you know, journalists love controversies, right? The one that always first comes to mind is the back pain acupuncture story from about a year ago now.
Right.
Where, yeah, there were multiple arms to the study. And this is one of the ones I was referencing. This is a large, well-controlled study that showed that it doesn't matter where you stick the needle or even if you stick the needle, the, you know, randomly poking people with toothpicks was just as effective as doing the full-on, you know, acupuncture. And that was reported in the press as acupuncture works. They go on to say placebo acupuncture works, which is, again, very misleading. No, placebo right. acupuncture doesn't work. Acupuncture doesn't work. That's how we interpret that study. And that's also it's my favorite example to use to my colleagues who are still green, you know, who don't understand what's going on. And their jaw hits the floor when you explain this to them, what the results were versus how it was presented by the proponents and in the media. It's like immediate, it's a slap in the face. It's like, you know, that's fraud. You know, that's so misleading. It's hard to say, call it anything other than fraud when a dead negative study is presented as acupuncture works as the bottom line.
Well, we have another one here. Question from Stacy B.
Recently, the scientists cure cancer, but no one takes notice story made its way around the internet again. To the best of my knowledge, no mainstream media outlets covered it, which makes sense because it was a load of hooey. But could it be detrimental to have no media response to crazy stories? Does that feed into the conspiracy?
Yeah, this is dichloroacetate. I did write about this on Neurologica, my blog, and we did talk about it this week on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, my podcast. But basically, this has been going around for years, several years at least. This is an approved drug that is being studied for its anti-cancer activity. It has a very interesting mechanism of action. A lot of cancer cells will get their energy by burning glucose without oxygen because they don't have much of an oxygen supply. The tumors tend to outgrow their blood supply, and that's how they stay alive. And this drug has the potential of forcing their mitochondria into burning oxygen to get their energy, and that can trigger the cancer cells to die, what we call apoptosis. They just lyse and they're dead. Nice story, looks great on paper, interesting, provocative, preliminary data. It needs to be studied clinically. The amount of research that is going on is completely appropriate given where we are with the evidence. It's happening. There's no conspiracy. There's nothing unusual about it. It's just like a dozen other drugs out there that are interesting and compelling. And, you know, eventually either it'll work or it won't work. If it works, I suspect it'll be just one more drug in the chemotherapy toolkit. If it doesn't work, or if it has too much toxicity, then it will be discarded. Maybe it'll have some other application, but it's not going to be, you know, a treatment for a cancer. But it was available for sale online without a prescription by, you know, non-physicians, and that was shut down by the FDA, which also fuels conspiracy theories. But it's just, you know, there's nothing unusual about it. It's interesting. It needs to be further researched. It is being further researched. The whole story is just an urban legend.
So is it detrimental to have no media response to those kind of stories then?
It's another double-edged sword, because when you pay attention to stories like this, you do tend to promote them. Even, and the literature shows this too, that it's very easy to inadvertently create or reinforce the myth or the false belief that something is true just by saying it's not true. There is what we call the familiarity heuristic. The more familiar we are with a claim, the more likely we are to think that it's true, and we may forget the detail that it's not true. So then later down the road, we say, oh, yeah, wasn't there something about vaccines and autism? I got to be worried about that. Or, yeah, wasn't there some drug that cured cancer that is being suppressed? But people will remember the story. It'll be familiar to them. Therefore, they'll give it credence, but they won't necessarily remember the details, or like the detail that it's not, in fact, true, that it's an urban legend. So you got to be careful with it. I think there was a social media internet, you know, promotion of this story. And there was a social media internet backlash against it by, you know, those of us in the skeptical scientific community. Maybe that's the appropriate response. If it does get any mainstream media attention, then we'll try to match it with appropriate, you know, correcting information. But, you know, it's one of those genie is out of the bottle thing. There's really no perfect response. You know, ignoring it is bad. Addressing it is a double-edged sword. You just got to be careful and monitor, you know, what's happening. But, you know, we tend to err on the side of getting the information out there. At least what I find, and here's the thing that is often not considered in this calculus, when there are individual people who are actually at the point where they're trying to make a decision, they have cancer, they want to know if they should buy this drug or not, or seek it out from some other country or whatever, they will go online and they will do a search and to read what's on there. If there's no skeptical information or scientific information about it, then they'll tend to believe what they're finding. If every website is saying, yeah, this is a cure for cancer that's being kept from you, they'll believe it. If they come up against one site that's credible and that's science-based and it says, nope, here's the actual information, it's an urban legend, here are the sightings, here's the references, that has a tremendous impact on that one person who is in the process of making that decision.
Exactly.
And that's something you have to consider, not just the guy in the street who's not making a decision. What does he think? You know what I mean?
We have a question from the website from Ben Radford.
Which areas of medicine do you feel are especially vulnerable to being misunderstood by the public, either because of their complexity or because journalists just don't understand what the story is about?
Well, I just think medicine in general fits that description, but certainly there are areas where it's worse. Certainly my own field of neuroscience, this is probably my own bias, but I certainly encounter a lot of stories, even by journalists who are generally scientifically savvy, know what they're talking about, or do a decent job. It's really easy to get bamboozled by a very complex neuroscience story when you start talking about transcranial magnetic stimulation and functional MRI scanning, and you know the way the brain is organized and the way it functions, and different types of diseases and disorders and syndromes and what these things all mean. It's very easy to get confused, especially if there are outlets out there that are trying to muddy the waters, that are trying to sow confusion and are doing it in a sophisticated way. So that is definitely one area. Another area are the cutting-edge technology, whatever hasn't been around long enough for people to get familiar with. So today, that's stem cells, right? That's one of the cutting-edge, sexy, mm-hmm. and even controversial technologies. So people are susceptible to claims that, you know, there's a stem cell clinic somewhere in India or China or in South America that will cure you of your ALS or your multiple sclerosis or whatever. You know, we find a lot of people are susceptible to that because they hear that there's a lot of promise and potential for stem cells. They know it's being research was being suppressed in the U.S. for a while, so it makes sense you'd have to go out of country for it. It's the discovery that we're about to make that's also – because it has that sort of superficial plausibility. And it's hard for people to know the difference between a cutting-edge therapy that's still being researched and not quite ready for therapeutic use versus something that's right at the beginning of therapeutic use.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're discussing science-based medicine with Dr. Steve Novella. We'll be right back with more after these brief messages.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Steve Novella, academic clinical neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine. It isn't just in the media where alternative treatments are getting traction. As you mentioned earlier, a lot of medical schools are offering instruction.
That's right. Again, as I said, in the United States, the body that accredits medical schools actually forces medical schools to teach alternative medicine. So they don't even have a choice anymore. They have to cover it in some way. And some do cover it in a reasonably science-based way, but most, they don't have the expertise. They don't have the people at the institution with scientific expertise in how to think about these therapies. And so they tend to turn it over to people who are using and promoting these therapies, and they do, of course, a credulous job of teaching it. They're promoting it. And I've, you know, I had an opportunity to speak to a lot of medical students, both at my own institution and, you know, online or email, you know, from other institutions as well. And, you know, you get the same mix that we see with physicians in general or practitioners in general, where, you know, a lot of them are like, oh, okay, it's fine, but, you know, they don't really think too much about it. Some are offended by it because it's unscientific, and they think that they're, you know, being taken advantage of, or, you know, they're paying for a top-notch science-based, you know, medical education, and then their school puts them in a classroom with somebody teaching them nonsense, and they don't like that. And then there's the 3-5% that's pretty consistent level there always seems to be, who are in favor of it. They take a very, you know, spiritual approach to their practice, or this is just in line with their worldview, their philosophy, and they're very enthusiastic about it. It's a, you know, it turns into a vocal minority, which then tends to drive it even further.
Well, do you think that aspiring doctors are better able to see through sciencey sounding jargon, or are they not?
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, obviously, the more science education you get, the better able you are to parse that. But, you know, medical school itself is more of a trade necessarily than teaching real hardcore science. You can manage to get through medical school without learning critical thinking, but, you know, just learning technically, you know, how to apply the trade of medicine well. I think that doctors who do that are not our best physicians. They're not the best doctors out there.
You are diplomatic, sir.
Thinking critically is I think an important skill to learn to being any kind of a practitioner like this, but there certainly are a lot who managed, you know, to not learn that as when they get through medical school, because it isn't a science, it's an applied science, it's a trade, and there's a difference there. And again, I think that it's easy to get blinded and confused by the superficial aspects of the alternative medicine movement. You know, because they touch a lot of buttons that people have. You know, that you're doing what's good for patients. If you care about patients, you'll want to try everything to help them. That, you know, you want to treat the whole patient, you know, holistic medicine. We want to use natural therapies that are more gentle, that work with the body. They really got their jargon down good. And if that really synergizes with your philosophy, you know, maybe you'll gloss over the glaring scientific problems with right. the actual treatments they're promoting.
But I guess one of the problems is it's not just a problem that they're treating people using alternative therapies, but these are the same doctors that get phoned and asked for quotes about different therapies, and so they spread that misinformation out.
Yeah, again, it tends to be the promoters who are looked on as the experts, right? So you want to find an expert in acupuncture, you find an acupuncturist. But unfortunately, within the community of homeopaths, acupuncturists, naturopaths, I would even say the majority of chiropractors, though certainly not all, there is not a culture of dedication to science, of really critically analyzing their own practices, their own beliefs, their own claims, and trying to weed out, you know, what works from what doesn't work. One of the strengths of the medical profession, again, we're far from perfect, but I do think one of the strengths is that, first of all, we're not monolithic. It's not one specialty. It's made up of many, many different specialties, and to a degree, we sort of keep each other honest. You know, you might have non-surgeons evaluating surgical outcomes, and they have no stake in it. You know, there's actually, in fact, a little bit of competition, and that's good, you know, for looking over each other's shoulders and keeping each other honest. But there's just this very deeply inbred culture of science, evaluating what we do, asking the hard questions, challenging even, you know, long-held beliefs or wisdom, and then changing what we think and changing what we recommend and do based upon that evidence. The problem with much of the professions that fall in the alternative medicine end of the spectrum is that they don't have a culture of science, right. of self-criticism, of changing what they do. They sometimes even cite as a strength how ancient their treatments are. You know, homeopathy has been around. They're doing the same thing they were doing 200 years ago. That's a weakness. The fact that these ideas are pre-scientific and they haven't changed, even in the light of our massively changing understanding of how the body works, that should be looked upon as a weakness. But again, they manage to turn everything on its head and turn that into a positive.
We have a question from Stuart Foreman.
I'm a physician, and until about 5 or 6 years ago, I was very tolerant of alternative medicine. I was even co-chair of the CAM committee at my hospital. But about 5 years ago, I had a personal paradigm shift, did a complete 180, and now I am quite vocal about any therapy that isn't science-based. Are you able to convert physicians to science-based thinking who previously have been lazy about their thinking about CAM?
Yeah, absolutely. And I get a lot of emails just like that one from the converted, if you will. You know, not maybe a loaded term, but those who were former shruggies and then were converted to skeptics or science-based advocates. And it's remarkably easy. All you really have to do for most people is just show them what it is, just educate them about what alternative modalities actually are. Most physicians even don't know what homeopathy is. They don't know that the remedies are diluted to the point where there's no active ingredient left, zero, and that the proponents are saying, not that it's like natural herb-based medicine, which is what most people falsely assume, but that it's based upon this pre-scientific magical thinking, sympathetic magic, you know, diluting therapies to the point where there's no active ingredient left, but it contains the magical spirit essence of whatever was previously dissolved.
You made that up.
This is what homeopaths really believe. And when I tell people this, they often go, no, that can't be it. That's just, no. No, no. And then, you know, if I can convince them that, yes, this is what they actually believe, that's all it takes. Then they're outraged. Then they're offended. Like, really?
Right.
Then they get outraged. And then I laugh. It's like, how naive that you're outraged. Welcome to the 21st century. You know, this has been going on now for 20 years. Where have you been? One of my colleagues, David Cahoon, who's in the UK, who's doing a great job fighting for science-based medicine over there, has hit upon a really good strategy. When there are gullible alternative medicine courses in medical schools, he makes a freedom of information request for the syllabus. And then he sends the syllabus to the board of directors.
Interesting.
That's it. That's all it takes. And then they're embarrassed and outraged about what's being taught in their own university or their own medical school because they didn't know. Because it was all happening under the radar, which is also another theme. The alternative medicine movement, especially in academia, is all under the radar. Nobody wants to really expose it to the light of day too much. And you know, I asked one person about that, and the answer was, you know, if it was all out in the open, then people wouldn't want it. And he was saying this as if this is a justification for doing it all on the sly under the radar. I'm like, yeah, think about what you just said. Academics and professionals wouldn't want this nonsense if they knew what was actually going on. That's the point, that we need to have a public, transparent debate. How could you honestly be advocating for doing this in secret because academics would be offended by it if they knew what it actually was? The implication there, of course, was that, oh, we're just being closed-minded, you know, and we're not open to these new ideas. But that's, again, now we're just adhering to logic and evidence.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Dr. Steve Novella, academic clinical neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine. He's also the host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. So you are not just sitting around lamenting the sorry state of health news. You are doing a lot about this. You're working to help people understand the problem. So we've talked about science-based medicine, the concept. Tell us about science-based medicine, the website, because I'd love to send people there.
Yeah, so science-based medicine is a joint project of the New England Skeptical Society and the James Randi Educational Foundation, and we got about 10 regular bloggers there, you know, all physicians or healthcare professionals, about another 10 who blog intermittently, and we do take outside submissions. It's a semi-edited blog, you know, so the authors who have already been vetted and we have experience with can post directly. But new submissions or new authors, we pretty heavily edit and review before we post them. So it's not, you know, it's kind of a semi-online journal, you know, semi-blog. It's a little bit of a blurring the lines between the two. But, you know, the bottom line is just we'd like to have as high-quality content on there as possible. And also, we write simultaneously to the general public as well as to our professional colleagues, which I think is a very good writing style, actually. And I think more people should do that. And we will dissect news items, therapies, questions, topics. We will often respond to the alternative medicine community when they write editorials advocating for the watering down of science standards. And we say, this is what they're saying, and this is what it means, and this is why it's wrong. It's, you know, so we try to get engaged in that conversation as much as possible. It's been very successful as far as that's concerned. We've, you know, had meetings with the head of the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, the NIH, based upon, you know, what we've written on SBM. You know, my Dr. Oz show appearance stemmed from science-based medicine. So I think it's working. We're, you know, inserting ourselves into the conversation, educating the public, you know, trying to correct, you know, bad media when it's out there. You know, our fingers are in the dike, as it is, as it were. You know, it's an uphill battle, but I have a great group of dedicated physicians and healthcare professionals who are working there.
Well, that leads directly to the fact that you're the director of the Science-Based Medicine Initiative at the James Randi Educational Foundation. So what kind of work are you doing there?
So this is brand new. It's really just started May 1st. So I'm working with DJ and James Randi and, you know, the whole, you know, JREF organization to build that. So in the short term, we are you know, supporting the science-based medicine website. I'm working with some of their existing investigations and projects. But also, we're having a conversation right now about where we should expand that to. We definitely want to produce educational material for patients, for physicians, you know, create other material that will help us get involved with the conversation. And it's essentially, you know, I'm very happy that the JREF is dedicated to promoting science-based medicine, and they're bringing their vast resources to bear in this project. So we're certainly expecting great things in the future.
Well, on that note,
this question is from Okalia. Do the public have a skewed view of science and medicine as seen through media portrayal of these things? How do we teach people to look through this?
So the media has very few themes that they tend to go back to over and over again. Every advance in medicine is a breakthrough. And this is, you know, I think, partly comes from the headline writers, but that's how it's seen. Whereas most science, especially today, you know, we've sort of already picked all the low-hanging fruit, had the major massive discoveries about basic knowledge about how things work. You know, as science progresses and matures in any discipline, advances tend to be more and more incremental, and refinements and deepening our understanding. And so that's the way it is with medicine today. There's tons of science being done. Most of it is very incremental. In the aggregate, it produces a nice, steady progress, I think, in our understanding and the effectiveness of our treatments. But that's harder to convey in a exciting way. And so every time we understand something a little bit better about a virus, it's the cure for the common cold, because that's one of the memes, one of the themes that they want to hit. Every time that we make some advance in understanding anything to do with cancer, it's a, this might lead to a cure for cancer. Well, you know, any new bit of information we get might lead to a cure for something. But that's how they always frame it. And then I think the public gets frustrated. Well, I've been reading about a cure for the common cold and a cure for cancer for the last 30 years. Where are they? Is it all a scam? And yet the steady progress that has been made over the whole time is maybe missed because these stories are not put into the proper context, either historically or scientifically in terms of our understanding. It really does create a distorted view. As a physician, I encounter this all the time. Patients assume that medicine is practiced like Dr. House practices it, which is very distorted because they have to tell a story, and that story has to be compelling. The Dr. House version of medicine is you have some brilliant insight as to the diagnosis. You make the correct diagnosis, and that leads you to cure the patient. I often encounter that assumption that that's the way medicine progresses or functions, and therefore they want me to give them the magic answer that will lead to a cure for whatever their problem is.
Right.
But that's very rarely how medicine progresses. More often than not, we're doing, you know, an evaluation, a series of diagnostic tests to rule out things that are possible, but even if they're unlikely, to narrow the field of possibilities that might be going on. We can treat patients without a specific diagnosis. Diagnoses are often partial or categorical anyway, so it's not a black or white thing where you know nothing or everything about a patient. You often know something in the middle, like, oh, this is something inflammatory going on, but I'm not sure exactly what. Let's try an anti-inflammatory and see how that works. I often have to educate patients about the fact that, you know, knowing what you don't have is as or more important than knowing exactly what you do have. And it's good that these tests are negative. It's amazing that I have to tell patients that it's good that they don't have some horrible disease.
Yeah.
Some patients, they are more frightened of the uncertainty than of having some horrible disease in some cases, especially if they're frustrated after a long process of not having an answer. And this is where I think physicians need to learn better, and on the whole, some are better than others, how to communicate all this to patients and how to confront their expectations and maybe some of their misconceptions. Sometimes I'll see patients who have seen other neurologists before, and the only thing I really do for them is explain to them what's going on. The other neurologist did everything there was to do medically, but they just didn't convey to the patient where they were with things. The patient was left with this sense that they didn't know what they had, they didn't know what was going on, they felt uncertain and scared, and they wanted another opinion. And you know, there was nothing missing in their workup or their treatment except a 5-minute or 10-minute explanation as to what the hell was going on. But a lot of that is undoing these media-generated or just, you know, culture-generated misconceptions about how medicine usually progresses.
Dr. Novella, thank you so much for helping us wade through all of the misinformation. And I don't mean just on the show. I mean, like, with your life.
Well, it's my pleasure.
You can find Dr. Steve Novella at the myriad places we've linked to on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review.
What exactly is wisdom, and how can we apply it in our daily lives? On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by past guest Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp to discuss their new book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. And we're joined by Brendan O'Brien to learn about 60 Second Science, the International Science Video Competition. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here with Maria Walters, one of the skeptchick.org writers and organizer of the Atlanta Skeptics. Welcome back, Maria.
Thanks, Des. It's good to be here.
So me and thee are doing something rather interesting next month.
We are putting together what we're calling a grassroots skepticism workshop as part of what we call Skepticon. It's a skeptical and science track at Convergence, which is a big science fiction convention in Minneapolis. The skeptics have been putting this on for a couple of years now, where we have a track focused on science and skepticism as part of Convergence. It's been a big success. This year we decided we wanted to take it to a different level, and we wanted to actually offer something to people who were already kind of identified as skeptical or who were interested in kind of learning more about doing science and skeptical activism. So we're putting on a grassroots skepticism workshop where you and I are going to be basically talking about how to really do activism in the context of skepticism, how to be effective, and some of the best practices, and do like a really kind of hands-on workshop as to where to go next.
Why do you think people would want to get involved in sort of science-focused activism in the first place? Isn't reading blogs and listening to radio shows enough, Maria?
I think that radio shows and blogs are extremely valuable. I also think that at the end of the day, some people want to kind of take that to the next level. I know with my experience with the Atlanta Skeptics, you know, we've been blogging, we've been doing regular Skeptics in the Pubs and meetings and sort of social gatherings as well as educational events for a couple of years now. And really the logical next step for a lot of people is, okay, we want to kind of take this to the streets and actually do something about all of these things that are, you know, that we're seeing as issues in society that really can be helped with additional critical thinking and additional skepticism. You know, some of the examples I think are outbreaks of pertussis and measles that we're seeing across the country, particularly in California. You know, we've got skeptics who are trying to put together vaccine clinics to help with that. So those types of events, which really can help you kind of navigate these issues and really feel like you're doing something real and tangible to make a difference.
So this is a very practical workshop on how to take your love of science and critical thinking and use it to change the world then.
That's what we're hoping. Yeah, I think we've put together something that's sort of the workshop that I think you and I wanted to attend.
And that's exactly it.
As we have all of these organizations that are popping up around the country and around the world, they're kind of going off and doing activism on their own in their own way. And sometimes it's effective and sometimes it's not. But I think that, you know, having kind of a toolbox or a handbook on just some of the very basic things that you can do to make sure you're putting together an effective campaign and to make sure that you're understanding if you are going to be effective, what your goals are, those types of things. We're just sort of trying to put together something that somebody who's never really had a whole lot of experience with activism can look at and say, here are some real tangible things that you can do that you should consider in order to get into this. Because I think activism can be a little daunting to begin with, and there are probably a slew of questions around, am I doing it right, and are there any risks involved with it? And I think those are the types of things we want to address.
So what do people need to know then? When and where, first of all?
It's going to be on Thursday, June 30th in Minneapolis. It's going to be at the Convergence Hotel, which is the Sheraton Bloomington in Minneapolis. You do not need to have paid to go to Convergence to attend this workshop. This is actually happening prior to the start of the conference. So if you are going to Convergence, you can come, but if you're not, that's fine as well. So it's Thursday, June 30th from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m.
And we are encouraging people to pre-register as well.
Yes, we would like for you to pre-register. The event itself is free. We are going to be providing take-home materials and lunch, so we are asking for a suggested donation when you register, but you don't have to. That just is to help cover the costs of those materials. If you can't pre-register on our site, then we'll know. We may even give you some pre-work to do, but we'll see about that.
So if you live in Minneapolis or you're planning to travel to Convergence and you think maybe you're curious about all this activism stuff, we would love to see you there. We have a link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com that goes directly to the registration page because we're servicey that way. Maria, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bell. ourselves, cause we're skeptically speaking. Our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.